And we are back with episode 250 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and that just shoots to heck my fantasies of John Barrowman becoming my sugar daddy.
And this is Brunson from Australia, and I think we should all take a moment to appreciate the time Jesus punched Lucifer in the face and tossed him in the boot of a car.
Yeah, I don't remember that book, but I think I would have probably been a big fan of it if it had been in there. But anyway, yes, we are going to be talking about Homeland, Person of Interest, Supernatural, and wrapping it up with another episode of Arrow. But first, Edmund, if you could please.
We will be talking about anything and everything in these episodes, so there will be spoilers ahead. However, as always, we've waited a while before we do that, so you've had time to watch all these fabulous things.
Absolutely. And we are going to go ahead and start with Homeland, and here is the promo.
You have become unsure of your commitment to our mission.
I don't know anything about a mission.
This man has been off the radar the past 12 hours in the company of known terrorists.
We need to be extremely fucking vigilant here.
Time's ticking away. We have to play this out.
Your wife and children have nothing to fear if you stay true to yourself.
There's a threat.
Is it Brody?
Everything that goes wrong right now is my fucking dad.
Who's really running this operation, David? I think you're the only one who understands this fucker needs watching like a hawk.
Each of us must decide what we can or cannot do.
And that promo is basically doing everything possible to force us to have an explicit tag. So I counted three F-bombs.
Thanks, Homeland.
Yes, F-bomb land. Yes, so this is Homeland. Season 2, Episode 9, Two Hats. Things for Brody are threatening to spiral out of control, forcing him to make a phone call he has been avoiding. Carrie preps for a pivotal meeting. Saul teams with Virgil and Max for an assignment. And apparently they drop F-bombs. All the time. Ah, well.
Welcome to the wonderful world of intelligence.
Indeed. All right, well. Wow, this was another surprising episode. I can just say that I wasn't expecting the whole affair with Mike to come back roaring to the show.
Oh, please, that's been coming for a while.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't think it was going to happen quite this way. So
maybe not quite this way, but they've very much been building up towards it for the past like half a season. I mean, since you had the thing with Mike poking around in the death of Tom Walker and that, and that one scene with Carrie where Carrie's just very much just like, okay, chill, we're going to let this play out, and then I'm going to take Brody, and you're going to take, you know, the wife, and it's all going to be cool. And just since then, I've just felt I've been waiting to sort of spring that back into the narrative, and with him riding to the rescue, it's in this episode, it was a natural place for things to bubble up again.
Mm. Yeah, it didn't surprise me too much either. I mean, I've got, you know, and especially, I mean, once the situation got set up the way it did seem relatively natural. But, you know, I think what was more surprising in this episode was just the whole thing in terms of everything with the intelligence operations. You know, they just keep going, you know, at this helter-skelter pace where, you know, the last thing I expected was, you know, this episode to end with them, you know, trying to roll everybody up. You know, and it just seems like, you know, all season, it's like, you know, whether it's, you know, him getting taken in to the Gettysburg ambush, you know, to this, it's like, you know, they compared to last season where there was, you know, sort of, you know, this sort of more studied pace and, you know, and this sort of slow tension building, it's like this season, it's like, you know, they're going much more over the top with the plot twist, and you know, I'm still enjoying it, but it does feel like, you know, like a, you know, this completely different approach to, you know, just ramming the story along.
I don't mind that so much. For one thing, it feels like the pace sort of feels like a bit more like a continuation of the previous season, I guess, rather than sort of stopping cold and building from the start again as other shows of this ilk have been known to do, the spy shows and the cable shows and that. But I also like the idea that in terms of how they deal out the plot, they're being a bit different because it's something interesting about these this breed of cable shows that's cropped up over the last 10 years is that they do is that it's very much the novel approach, not the novel book sort of approach of making every season its own thing. And this is the a little more Empire Strikes Back, I guess, of just we're gonna start big and go bigger and keep things moving at a huge at a really really fast pace compared to last season, which got us in with one character and just very slowly expanded out into the rest of this this cast of characters and this tapestry and timeline of things happening.
Yeah, although I mean, I realized as you were saying that, I mean, one thing that it I think it does reflect is, you know, the fact that our two main characters are way more on the edge and, you know, and falling apart this season. So it's like the whole pace and plotting of it is reflecting that. I mean, certainly they were setting that up, you know, right in the pilot, as you know, with Carrie, you know, being dragged back in when she may or may not be really ready. And certainly, you know, Brody's just being whipsawed from, you know, loyalty to loyalty and situation to situation. Whereas last season, it was, but both of them were kind of, you know, had things together more, where they both had, you know, had their sort of routine and their focus. And, you know, yeah, one of them was focused on blowing up the vice president, but, you know, but things were kind of more ordered in their lives, you know, and now things, you know, really have gone off the deep end. So
though you mentioned, Brody whipping back and forth a bit. This episode, I felt like, marked a bit of a return to the ambiguity of the previous season. I mean, as soon as he gets back and he starts making the phone calls and stuff like that, there is the sense that he is definitely trying to do right by his family and still a bit of conflict. But now I've gone back to not being sure who he's with. Mm-hmm. Was I the only one who felt like that, or...?
I think that he's gotten to the point where he's not sure where he stands, and I think that that's the natural consequence of the previous three episodes. We've seen him slowly but surely breaking down in terms of his own psychology, and I think that having Abu Nazir come into the forefront again has kind of thrown his entire world into a blender, because before, at least all he had giving him direct orders was the CIA. I mean, yes, there was Roya, and she was occasionally kind of pushing him, and that was causing tension, but he didn't have that presence of the man who had turned him right there to kind of push him into really testing his loyalty. So I think that by the end of this episode, you definitely have this question of, which side is he going to go onto? I mean, that's one of the interpretations of the title of the episode. You know, two hats. Which one is he really wearing?
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, that also applies to, I believe, it's Quinn.
Mm.
And where is his loyalty really at? What is the purpose there? The idea that there may be a plan to take out Brody once they get Nazir is, in retrospect, not that surprising, but it really kind of came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It's logical enough, well, but
the idea of Quinn being more than he seems has been simmering in the background from like the what was it, like episode 2 or 3 when they set up the big new task force thing. It was just that sense of like, you know, Estes has very specifically brought this guy in, and then we haven't learned anything about him. Just that he's sort of. He's distrustful of Brody, and he's distrustful of Carrie and stuff like that. But they really haven't commented on it. But they have been laying all these seeds of him being this complete other presence. That for being part of the task force, he's not with these other characters. And I mean, the fact that he is the only one who is very new this season kind of it really helped with that, because you can. The audience can kind of dismiss their things as just like, well, we don't know anything about this guy, which, you know, and those suspicions are immediately squashed by things like, okay, well, he's the new guy. We've known everyone else for a season already, mm-hmm. and now it's just they're pulling trigger on it, so to speak.
Well, yeah, no pun intended, right? Because he didn't pull the trigger. But I guess the fact that he was a bit of a cipher earlier on, the... Maybe you could take the assumption that, okay, he's there to keep an eye on Carrie and Saul because of their past history, but to then take it to the next level and have him be basically an assassin in waiting, And it really makes you wonder, okay, yes, he's there to take out Brody, but is Brody going to be the only one that they take out?
Mm.
How much of a threat do they think Carrie is?
Oh, sure.
You know, and for that matter, you know, Saul is clearly under suspicion, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they are definitely playing around with that. And it does feel a little abrupt as far as the twist is concerned, but I think that's just because they decided to play the cards that way. But it, as you were saying, Bronstone, that earlier in the season, there were these hints that this was something lying in wait. I think it was a lot more set up than some of the other things that we saw. Like Nazir showing up in America just is out of nowhere. And they still haven't really made sense of that. You know, they're like, oh, how did he get in here? And everybody just puts a lampshade on it. But unless they're going to come along and have some kind of huge revelation that one of the main characters is actually a mole.
Right. I don't know about a main character, but I think that this is a spy show. We're all kind of waiting for it, I think.
Yeah, okay, so who's our top suspect, then, for who brought Nazir in?
It's clearly Carrie's dad.
Edmund, how about you?
At this point, I really have no idea. I mean, they've just been, you know, just sort of hinting at it, and to my mind, I mean, not really dropping enough, you know, enough hints for me to even guess. So I'm going to wimp out and not say anybody.
Oh, no, I'm going to throw out three opportunities here. Okay, my like high percentage shot is Mike, just because. My probably middle ground one is Dana, of course. And then, of course, the one that I think is probably the biggest gamble, Saul's hat. I'm just trying to read the writers here. Yeah, nobody has a cat or a dog.
No, you want the guy who no one will see coming because they've never done anything in the show to think. Brody's son.
There you go.
Right.
That's it.
Why did we keep him around for two seasons, even though he has no bearing on the plot?
Super Muslim. Yes, that'll be it.
I think you'll find that's coming on. That's going to be on Fox.
Yeah, I had the wrong channel. You're right.
Yeah, all that love of big screen TVs is just a cover.
That's it. Well, you see, he loves those big screen TVs because he can see the destruction of America better on them. Yeah. It's a theory. All right. Clearly, we've run out of things to say about this episode.
Yeah. The one thing I do want to say is, in terms of that, I did really like. I mean, just, I'm speaking of mole stuff. I mean, of course, I mean the way they were teasing. You know, Quinn is the mole when you know, with his incredibly spare apartment that, you know, looked like it's for somebody who's just camping there while he does a job.
Mm-hmm.
But then the whole, bringing it around to, yes, this guy with a name like a terrorist, but is in fact not a terrorist. He's just this deeply secretive dark ops guy who scares the crap out of both Saul and Virgil. So, I did like the way they played that out. And of course, the fact that it's F. Murray Abraham, does bring the prospect of even more wonderfully acted scenes in the next few episodes. So,
oh, absolutely. Now, okay, so the reviewer gave this one a 7, which was a little surprising to some. But let's see, what would you give it, Bronstone?
I'd like to go an 8. 8 has become the standard for this show, which says a lot about how consistently excellent it is.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot to like. There was the surprising resolution in that it resolved one of the big threats of the season and was the climax of the episode itself. And I was surprised they decided to let's wrap this up and go on to something else really quick. I like the way that they sort of dealt with the stuff with Mike and the stuff with Quinn. And yeah, it's just, it was good value.
Mm. How about you, Edmund?
I'll go with an 8 as well. I mean, you know, a very good episode. I mean, there was, you know, certainly, you know, some of it felt, you know, a little bit set up. So, you know, leaving room for the more climactic stuff to come in the next, whatever we've got left, couple of episodes.
Yep, 3 after this. But I would also give it an 8. That actually brings this episode to a tie with a Gettysburg Address as the lowest scored episode of the season, but probably appropriately enough. Now, all I can say is this episode is clearly called Two Hats, so I feel like I'm justified in calling Saul's hat as a suspect, and that means there's another one out there somewhere. And yeah, it could be I'm reading into this show just a little much.
I'm sure F. Murray Abraham will wear a hat.
Too. Absolutely, he will. Come on, that's...
And the hats will be having a secret conversation.
That's it. Yeah. It'll be like the Two Towers, but it'll be the Two Hats. All right, well, since we've gone directly into lunacy, let's go back to that whole Jesus punching out the devil thing and talk about person of interest. And here's the promo.
How did two people go from being in love to wanting each other dead?
Being married, whole different animal.
This marriage comes...
Which I got a sniper on my six.
...with a different kind of contract.
The Drakes took out a hit on each other.
You are a stubborn pseudo-intellectual.
I'm sorry, which one of us went to Yale?
Apparently we underestimated their marital discontent.
You don't look like a police officer.
Thank you.
Somebody help me!
What is this?
Marriage counseling.
A new person of interest.
Well, yes, I'm a little surprised that this wasn't the Valentine's Day episode, but let's set that aside.
Oh, you and me both.
Yes.
I'm just really glad I didn't watch the preview beforehand, because it kind of spoils half
it
the
does,
episode.
It does, doesn't it? I did not watch the promo before watching it either, thankfully. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give us the recap?
Sure. This is Person of Interest, Season 2, Episode 8, Till Death. The team has to protect two persons of interest when the machine gives them the numbers of a husband and wife. And, of course, the most notable thing, since this is audio, so you didn't get to actually see the promo, is that, of course, as has already been alluded to, the husband was the ever good value Mark Pellegrino. So that was one of the pluses of this episode. And this whole thing of where, you know, this wound up being the episode to explore the romantic lives of everybody except for Reese, except, you know, well, we know Reese has Zoe off in the wings. So,
yeah,
you know,
he had his relationship episode earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think it would have been overload, but this was, I think they kind of did this a little bit more in the first season than they've been doing this season, but they do these sort of filler episodes every now and then, except with Person of Interest. I mean, they do everything so well that, you know, even though it's, you know, not necessarily, you know, giving us any hints about all the little stuff that's been going on in the background, whether it's the FBI or Stanton's return or what Root might be up to or Elias, it's still, you know, nice to have this episode where they're, dealing with this husband and wife trying to kill each other until, thanks to the ministrations of Mr. Reese, they finally start to see sense. And at the same time, to have Carter and Fusco finally getting a bit of a personal lives themselves. Fusco's semi-stereotypical, but in terms of, you know, yeah, going out to the fancy restaurant, you kind of felt like both of them are trying to impress each other until they realize, like, you know, no, we're, this isn't really us, let's, and then she winds up on the stage.
Get falafels and tell funny stories.
Yeah. And then with Carter, I mean, even though they're kind of telegraphing it with the detective and his rose petals line, given the way she's just been sort of, you know, just shown as this, you know, sort of driven, isolated figure on the police force, you know, it was kind of nice to have this possibility of, you know, her having, you know, a little something to go home to rather than just her son. So all that and just is the lead up to, you know, what was, you know, the really sort of awe moment of the episode, which was seeing the flashback to Mr. Finch courting his wife. I gotta say, you know, pretty amazing scavenger hunt he sent her on. Although it is kind of nice when you can rent out the Guggenheim just for two as the climax. But one of those episodes where they're kind of going in a different direction, but they made it work. Also, I just have to, you know, I mean, Mark Pellegrino's little freak out in the wine closet was just something to behold. So.
Yes. I'm envisioning him as either Lucifer or Jacob doing that.
Yeah.
And it works either way.
Just never seen someone so upset to be in a closet full of wine.
Well, sadly, he had other things on his mind and didn't think about that, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, this, it was an odd episode. I mean, never mind the oddity of having Fusco in a relationship on screen. That was bad enough, but, you know...
Yeah. That actually worked out.
It's exactly. It wasn't like a hapless thing. It was actually going fairly well. Even when things were going wrong, it was going well. The whole thing was kind of broadly comedic, as the promo suggests. And granted, at the same time, it was still lots of Reese kicking ass by the end of the thing. And, you know, like we said at the very top, Reese gets to punch Mark Pellegrino in the face, knock him cold, and throw him in the boot. So...
That was fun.
Yeah, that had lots of great genre crossover potential there. But it was an odd episode because it felt a little out of place, at least to me. I had fun watching it, but it didn't feel like it really came on the heels of the previous episode all that well. It was just there, like the echo was just a second ago. So I don't know. I'm It's one of those things where it felt like maybe this was an episode they thought they could just drop in anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I really can't say too much more about it because it was kind of self-contained. It was just a pleasant episode of Person of Interest. We've had fairly self-contained most of the time, but this is probably one of the most isolated episodes.
The neatest.
Yes.
I think like the first half of season one have we had episodes that just finished in such a tidy, you know, just such a neat, tidy way. I mean, it's possible we'll see, what are their names? Rhonda and Beecher? No? Okay. What's wrong with it? It's possible we'll be seeing them again, and I wouldn't mind that at all because I like the idea of those... of Carter and Fusco having a personal life, and I thought those scenes had a sweetness that you don't often see in Person of Interest. Though neither of them held a candle to the scavenger hunt.
Mm.
But yeah, it's very, very fire and forget.
Well, I mean, there is the oddity of realizing that the most romantic character on the show is Finch. which
somehow I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's still odd. Yeah. Especially if you're still associated with Ben Linus, but that's yeah. Okay.
Yeah, although I guess...
Ben Linus was romantic in his own psychotic way.
Oh, yeah.
True enough.
Although I guess we can think of, you know, yes, Finch was romantic then, but...
Yeah, well, now he's got his canine life mate, so...
Yeah, that's true.
They could not resist having at least one scene with him hanging out with the dog and...
Oh, of course not.
Yes, of course not.
No, that is now a staple of the show.
Absolutely. Bear has to have
so. All right. He's using Bear as an excuse to go and walk by Grace's place. That was a nice touch, I thought, especially because you had the episodes early in the season where him trying to take Bear out for a walk was the most terrifying thing, and now it's just become really routine in the best way. It's a nice, subtle little example of how the characters in the show do... grow and change, even if it's just a little bit at a time, and that sort of thing's even, you know, even shows up in an episode of the that we think of as comparatively weak.
Yeah, and also just as a former Manhattanite, I do like the fact that, you know, they are actually true to the city, because where the library is and where she lives, it is actually feasible for him to have walked there down there. So.
Mm-hmm.
another nice little, you know, touch of verisimilitude that they're injecting there.
Let's see. I would probably give this a 7. Isn't terrible. It's average, but it's the first time that I've gone quite that low this season. How about you, Edmund?
I'm torn between a 7 and an 8, but I don't think there's enough there to make it an 8. So I will stick with a 7. If they'd thrown in even a little hint of art stuff, then it might have gone higher. I'll keep with a 7 on it.
Okay. How about you, Brunson?
Yeah, I would go 7 for much the same reason. It was fun. It was a sweetness, but it doesn't hold a candle to some of the other things we've seen this season.
Hmm. Definitely agree. All right. Well, see, I agreed twice. All right. We are going to move on then to an episode that I have a feeling is going to be very divisive, and that is Supernatural. And here's the promo.
Wednesday, November 28th.
I'm gonna become a hunter.
His first case.
Sounds loony.
Do you boys chase the crazy, or does the crazy chase you?
Starts with a bang.
I'll handle this.
Why did you kill your husband?
I was being bad cop.
You were being bad everything.
Oh boy, okay, so Bronston, why don't you give us the recap here?
I can probably manage that. Supernatural Season 8, Episode 8, Huntery Heroic-y?
Close enough.
I'm going to assume that's it.
Hunter-eye, heroic-eye.
Heroic.
Okay. Yeah. They sound like Spartacus characters.
Well,
Sam
Latin.
And Dean take on a...
Go ahead.
Sam and Dean take on a case with Castiel, who has decided to become a hunter. However, they discover that the murder is only the latest... in a string of cartoon deaths. This was an odd one.
Yes.
And not just odd in the sense that cartoon things were happening.
Is it just me, or is this the least funny, zany episode ever written for a TV series?
Oh, no, it's not the least funny. However, it's very low by the standards of Supernatural.
Yes. Yeah. I felt like they were making great pains to just suck any type of hilarity out of it, to the point that when they finally started to really ramp things up at the end, when Dean was having the fight with the doctor, that was the only time that I actually realized what they were trying to do with the rest of the episode, because it just wasn't coming together for me.
Yeah, they were playing it too straight.
Yes, that's exactly
it. And sometimes that worked, like everything that Castiel does for the sake of a laugh. The straighter they play it, the better it works, because he's just such a gruff, serious character. But then the rest of all the cartoon stuff, the exploding cake and the heart and the black hole, you just had to sit back in the arch. That was supposed to be funny? Like, they weren't trying to portray this guy, like, all this stuff as, like, evil, bad Gurag? Yeah.
Exactly. It was like whiplash by the end. And then when they, do the Looney Tunes thing, it's kind of like, wait. Okay, I really feel like I should be like, this should be the capstone of this really funny, funny thing, and yet it just seems dissonant. It doesn't make sense. Of course, there's probably no greater wet blanket to throw on any hilarious plot thread than Sam meets his potential love interest father.
Yes.
Oh.
His imaginary potential love interest father.
Oh.
Yeah.
What a miscalculation of a mixture. I mean, I get what they were trying to do. I really do. But every single time they cut to that, it killed any momentum that the episode had. And I can't even say that it wasn't like fun to watch in a really awkward kind of way. But it just felt like it didn't belong in this episode at all.
It was like the show had suddenly decided to do a crossover with The Young and the Restless. The style, the type of story, and the way it's written, and even like the style that they used to film it. Like, I mean, they've been doing that with Sam's flashbacks for the entire season. That really soft focus, all that sort of stuff. But it just kind of like I felt it very keenly in this episode, and I felt like maybe when Sam was in his time off, like he somehow ran into the trickster and there was a he went back to TV land for a little while.
Yeah, he's stuck in a really, really bad soap opera episode.
Daytime soap.
Yes. It would only be funny if it was the soap that Jensen Ackles
if
used
was
to be on, yes.
If it was a telenovela.
Well, that too, but...
he can't speak Spanish.
Right, exactly. It just felt like it came out of nowhere. And they did that thing yet again of Sam just staring into the distance.
Yeah.
We made fun of it enough the first time, but it was even more egregious this time around. It was just, let me just stare into the background, and you could almost see the wavy dissolve about to take place.
I know!
If they did that, at least it would have been funny, but no, they
trying
probably...
Trying to remember that, I have to remind myself the fadey dissolve thing didn't actually happen.
Right, see? That's how much better it would have been that way.
And like, there's a cheesiness to it that they're just totally not playing with. Like, they could do something with it, and they're just not. I mean, it sort of continues to tie into this thing that's been going on for about half the season of fake memories and escaping things. And they're just like, this episode, it was like they were trying to make the sanding subtle and the Castiel thing really obvious in terms of paralleling what's happening with the guy whose name I'm totally blanking on. But it was just like, it's getting so ridiculously transparently obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this just was, what really surprised me is that, again, this is one where I went back and I was like, wow, who wrote this? Was this a new writer maybe? Or I don't know. And it turns out that it's like one of their staple writers since at least the third or fourth season. Someone who's been pretty, ooh. I think it was Andrew Dabb, who's been fairly consistent. That just surprises me because it's like, I know that, you know, there is the occasional misfire every so often with writers. I mean, it happens, but it just felt very uncharacteristic of that particular member of the writer's team. Let me just confirm that that's who it was. Yes, it was Andrew Dabb. Yeah, it just really felt off. The whole thing from start to finish. And when you have someone like Castiel who can throw out dialogue and make anything funny, I mean, the most genuinely funny moment of the whole thing was his interrogation of the cat. Until they had the cat talk. That to me was like, really? And that should have been, again, like the culmination of the whole thing, but it just felt meh. It's like it was funnier when he was just interrogating the cat.
Right. Yes.
That
exactly.
That was enough. If they had just made this about Castiel trying to be a hunter and just made his mishaps and his silliness and all of that the main focus of the episode, it would have been perfectly fine.
It would it would have been very funny.
Oh yeah. But then they
if they were deciding to go with this concept, and I that's what I suspect more than anything, but no, that, you know, this is one of those ideas they came up with in the writer's room, you know, and he was just the one who, wound up getting assigned to be the one to try and pull it off, you know. But I mean, if they'd gone with, you know, okay, it's kind of silly enough to have Castiel wanting to be a hunter, but then okay, he wants to be a hunter and he winds up with, you know, the Looney Tunes case. Mm-hmm. And just got more, you know, over the top Roger Rabbit with it, you know, it would have worked much, much, much better, you know. But instead, I mean, it was, you know, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, like, you know, they were trying to, you know, make it a serious case while they were interjecting cartoon stuff. And that, you know, and even the ending, you know, after, you know, you've had all this Looney Tunes stuff, you know, and then, because I can't, you know, like, I can't remember his character name because he's always Mike Farrell to me anyway, you know, and then Mike Farrell makes him shoot himself. You know? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, okay, yeah, I know it's supernatural, but still, you know, after you've just gone, you know, over the top wacky, it's like, you know, that's a little harsh.
You know, way to bring down any amusement you just got out of that scene.
Yeah, you know, yes, I understand he's been, you know, using and abusing him all this time, but still, it was like, just sort of whiplashing back and forth from, you know, trying to decide which tone they wanted to take.
I really felt like, and I mentioned this in my review, that they were trying to do a Roger Rabbit-esque type thing on a budget,
mm-hmm.
and it just didn't work. They just couldn't get it to happen. But yeah, like the thing with the cake just kind of happened. It led up to it. It was obvious where it was going, but then when it happened, it was just there. And then, you know, they had a pastry incident or something like that. And it's okay. That was the punchline.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess this wasn't as divisive as I thought it was going to be. I thought that at least somebody was going to defend it, but
you know, one of us would like it.
Maybe. Surely there's someone in the audience that's going to defend it. Call in if you would like. We would love to hear from you. Yeah, but this was easily my least favorite episode of the season. I mean, this, we may have said that the previous episode for Person of Interest was its low point of the season, but at least that just kind of fell to average, mm-hmm. which that's not so bad. But this to me was a drastically less effective episode. So I wound up giving this a 6, and I think I was being slightly generous with that. How about you, mm-hmm. Edmund?
Yeah, I'd say you were being generous with that. I mean, between, you know, maybe just the Roger Rabbit stuff a 6, but then with the combined with the flashbacks, it drops it to a 5 for me.
How about you, Brunstone?
I'll go with a 6. I think Castiel saved it from being wholly, wholly terrible.
Yes, I would agree, though, that Castiel was probably the thing that saved it from being a 5 for me. Although I was back and forth. This one was tough because as I was sitting there and thinking about it, I was like, okay, I haven't been this negative about the show this season. I've been pretty happy with it. I mean, there's been some average episodes along the way, but this is by far the lowest scored episode all season long. So, yeah, Misfire. I think that they made an attempt at something that was beyond their grasp, which is unfortunate. Oh, well. But we have one more episode to go over in our show, and that would be Arrow, and here is the promo.
Get down!
She spent a little less time trying to be a hero. You're obviously not very good at it.
They came for his family. Now, he's going after theirs.
So this is going to blow up into an all-out mob war.
There will be blood.
Be careful with my father.
You are doused with gasoline playing with matches.
Oliver, you're not falling for this girl, are you?
Arrow.
Okay, so we have Arrow, and let's go ahead with the recap once I bring it up. Because I was ready. All right, Arrow, Season 1, Episode 7, Muse of Fire. Oliver meets a kindred spirit, the daughter of a mobster who has her own desire for vengeance. Meanwhile, Tommy turns to Laurel for help.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened.
Yep. That's what happened. I'm sorry. It was so quiet, I thought that you guys had completely dropped. As if there was a glitch with the video. No, okay, maybe this is the one that we're going to be really divisive on. It sounds to me like this was not your favorite episode of Arrow.
I'm sort of gathering my thoughts a bit, but okay. I actually quite enjoyed it.
Okay, good. All right. So I'm not hearing anything from Edmund at all, so maybe... Did we drop it?
No, I'm okay. Here. Yeah,
so
no,
we're
I
staging
was,
like a protest.
Wow, we're all just like completely taken aback by the promo, I guess. I don't know.
And it's the inaccuracy towards what actually
happened. Oh, this has been one
episode,
completely, completely uncharacteristic episode for us. But anyway, it's worthy of 250. Yes. Yeah, so Arrow, I gotta say, for me at least, this was another knockout of the park. I continue to be impressed about how they're building and layering up this show. I did notice that there were some people that complained about Helena's characterization. It is Helena, right? Helena Bertinelli?
Yeah. Helena.
So, yeah, Helena, whatever. Huntress, damn it. So, but I thought that the fact that she was kind of a little flat in her line delivery and very guarded and withdrawn made a lot of sense, considering the fact that she really had come to the conclusion she couldn't trust anybody.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
She's also hanging out with this guy who is getting into business with her father.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I...
Yeah.
Oops.
Go ahead.
No, it's just I'm very much in the same boat of thinking this wasn't the line readings were a weakness on the part of the actress. They were just an accurate representation of the character. Because from that, we get who this person is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good acting.
Right. And,
it's like sort of textbook.
Well, what I really like about it is that, you know, it's one thing when you are up against somebody like, say, Deadshot, who is an assassin for hire and makes the claim that, hey, you're just like me. Oliver can kind of sit back and, in his nice little psychological cocoon that he's built for himself, say, I'm nothing like you. I'm justified in what I do. Right?
I've spent 5 years on an island figuring out why I'm doing this.
Exactly.
In a cave with a box of scraps.
That's right. But then you get this episode where now he's got somebody that he can kind of understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes off on a killing rampage. And he's kind of like, whoa, you can't do that. It's like, Oliver. You kill people regularly.
he's being handed a very an accurate mirror for really the first time in the show. I mean, like you said, he's been facing against people who. I mean, it's supervillain 101. If you want to, you know, rattle the hero, you just sort of say, "We're not so different, you and I," and then kind of cross your fingers that they get flummoxed for a bit.
Mm.
But here it's there's a legit point to be made, and he's by proxy he is. Questioning his own actions and
exactly.
his own justification, really, the whole episode, or at least that whole subplot, it really hinges on the connection between Oliver and Helena, and I think they did a really, really good job of that. The way that over the course of the date, you can see them both softening up, and that feeling, like, I really got the impression that both of them were, for the first time in a really, really long time, finding kindred spirits. Not quite realizing the extent of that until much later, but it was... Mm-hmm. It was nice to see Oliver unwind a little for what felt like the first time in ages. And from the way that the actress playing Helena was doing it, you could tell that she was going through a very similar thing. And yep. That connection balanced with the way, with what happens later and Oliver sort of taking objection to her actions and therefore his own, and that conflict that just made for really, really an interesting, watchable episode.
Yeah, it's one of those deals where, like you said, it's a reflection, right? And now Oliver needs to look at this and say, all right, is this the person that I could become? Or is this going to be some example for him of what he needs to avoid? Because it all depends on where they take her, right? Because obviously they are hinting that there's going to be this longer-term relationship between the two of them. My guess is that as they continue to develop things between Tommy and Laurel in the background... to kind of build up her her character's justification for later action. You know, they're going to have Helena here as this love interest for Oliver. She's going to be, you know, joining him in his little bend of merry destruction. And I can see her...
Merry man?
Yes, but she's not a man, so... I can see her not letting go of her hate. And that becoming a problem for Oliver because... The more that she can't let things go, the more he realizes he has to, because he has Dig to kind of be his conscience and to draw him away from that. You know, maybe he'll be tempted to get, you know, go a little bit darker, but he needs to find a way to moderate it. And could they become adversaries down the road? I think there's a pretty symbolic use for that down the line, especially if it becomes a matter of him overcoming this symbol of the part of him that he does not want to give into, this person who becomes consumed by vengeance, even as he's starting to find this mission outside of vengeance that Dig has already been pushing him towards. So I really like where this is already setting up. At the same time, there's also this little business of Tommy's father is John Berman's character.
Yeah.
And there's something that I missed along the way, and I guess maybe if Gary was watching this, he would have picked up on this a lot earlier. Their last name is Merlin. My understanding is, when I looked it up, because I've had this feeling, and I think I mentioned it a couple a while back when we were talking about one of the earlier episodes, that I keep feeling like Tommy is going to be this big, big adversary for Oliver.
Sure.
It just feels like they're setting him up to just implode and become this villain. Especially after this episode where his trust fund just disappears. But Merlin is apparently the name of Green Arrow's nemesis in the comics. You know, obviously being another archer who is, you know, his dark reflection again. But who has Tommy been trying to emulate ever since Oliver disappeared? He's been trying to basically be Oliver.
Right.
Especially with Laurel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I feel like as Tommy goes down this darker path, Laurel is going to be caught in between and feel like she has to do something at some point. And that could intersect very nicely with what happens later with Oliver and Helena. Again, I just felt like this entire episode was one big chunk of really smart setup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably no surprise that this was the episode that was co-written by Geoff Johns. Of DC writing fame.
Yes, even I know that's sort of a big deal.
Yeah, which the first episode that he wrote for Smallville I thought was really not that very good because it seemed to rely on a lot of previous knowledge of characters, but this time he seemed to really get the characterization within the show. And it probably helps that I believe that the other two main showrunners for this show actually have also written Green Arrow in the past, which I suppose is something that we should have known before, but I'm not that big of a DC fan, but as far as I know, that was, I think Andrew Kreisberg is one of them is one of the showrunners, and I think that he actually wrote for the comic at one point. It would make sense.
Yeah, he's written for Green Arrow and Black Canary, according to Wikipedia.
Okay, so there you go. And I don't know if...
Since Gary is threatening to catch up, we may at some point get his insights into this.
So. Right. Now, Kreisberg and I think it's... what's the other person's name? Guggenheim or something like that?
It's the three creators of the show. I don't know if they're all showrunners, but they are Andrew Kreisberg, Greg Berlanti, and Mark Guggenheim.
Okay, Mark Guggenheim is the one I'm thinking of. He is one of the writers on the digital comic that they have for Arrow, which does a really nice job of fleshing out the world and getting into motivations a little bit more here and there. So, yeah, I mean, it's really neat what they're doing. They're kind of getting people who really have a long-term understanding and vision of the character, and they're having them come in and create a reboot or a completely re-envisioning of the character. And for me, that probably is why it works so well. You know, it's not something that I necessarily think was done with Smallville and Superman, which probably is why that struggled so much over time.
I mean, that was one thing I was noticing in this episode is that, you know, yes, I mean, you know, obviously I only came in at the very end of Smallville, but, you know, but sort of, you know, heard tell of stuff in the earlier seasons, and the fact that it's on the CW, which sort of has had the, you know, the reputation of, you know, oh no, it's the, you know, it's the young teen network. And, you know, and I could see how in other hands, you know, I mean, an episode like this, where it's like, you know, oh, he's getting together with her and Tommy and Laurel are getting together. You know, this could have been done in a really obvious way that just completely was taking you out of the show, and the way they were developing those two relationships and making it, you know, very much integral and feel, you know, very much part of their characters and, you know, and very much part of the development of their characters, you know, I think is something we're not used to seeing on the CW, and that's a very good thing.
Well, you say that, but you know, at the same time, we've got Supernatural.
Oh, I know, but I'm just saying the overall reputation of
that. Right. Well, that's the thing that's really weird about the CW is that when you really think about it, yes, they've had a lot of schlock on there. I mean, they still have 90210, don't they? And you know,
Gossip Girl, and yes,
exactly. But they've had, you know, Supernatural, now Arrow, for my part at least, The Vampire Diaries, which is not at all what one would expect out of that premise, and then even Nikita, to a certain extent, kind of goes against the grain. So right there, you've got 4 out of 10 shows, or out of 10 hours of their programming that's not at all in line with what people have come to expect of their channel.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
So it's kind of odd, but there you are. I really enjoyed this episode. I have to go back and look to see exactly what I gave it. I think I gave it an 8. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I did. So, how about you, Bronstone? What would you give it?
I would go the same. Okay. 8 sounds really good. It was fun. It was smart. It did a lot of, great setup for things coming later. We had good reveals and stuff. It was just, I was incredibly happy with it.
How about you, Edmund?
I'll go with an 8 as well. And I just had to make specific mention. I did love the John Barrowman reveal of having him fencing was just a beautiful way of bringing in, you know, yes, he is a completely arrogant ass.
but I mean, how many times do you find the villain is you know, introduced because he's fencing? I mean, it's almost classic, you know?
Because it's an excuse to have them doing, like, A, showing that they know how to use a sword, and B, with a mask on, they can whip off in a dramatic moment.
That's right.
Exactly.
And that's totally a Captain Jack sort of thing.
So. Absolutely.
I'm smelling
there's
crossover.
There's a swordplay joke in there.
There is. All right, well, I mean, it's, once again, to underscore just how surprising it is, how good this show is, out of the 4 that we have reviewed in this episode, Arrow was the one that got the top score. Which, when you're comparing it to Homeland, Person of Interest, and Supernatural, who would have thunk it? But there we are. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time.
You're always asking me, what did I miss the most? Air conditioning, satellite radio,
Dahlia Deli.
Right. But those are the answers that I give people because those are the answers they're expecting.
Why can't you just be truthful?
I don't know how truthful I can be.
You've been through a crucible, and it changed you. How can it not?
That's beautiful. Your cross.
It's a gift. For my fiancé.
I didn't know you were engaged.
I'm not. Anymore. He died.
I'm sorry.
Me too. That was my crucible.
Boy, it's nice to... It's really nice to be with someone that I can be myself with.
It's nice to be with someone who knows how hard it can be.
I'm really sorry.
It's okay. Take it.
Thank you. Yep.
Hey, it's Dick. Something came up. You gotta get out of there and call me back.
Helena, I have to go. There's something that I have to do. It's about my mother. Otherwise, I would stay.
And I would like that. My father would kill me if I let you pay.
I have a confession. I didn't want to go out with you tonight.
That makes two of us.
I'm really glad that I did.
That makes two of us. Oliver, be careful with my father.